Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to look at the mobilisation of the German and the Austro-Hungarian armies in 1914, following the July crisis and the first moves towards actual all-out European war. One of the reasons why I want to talk about this is because one of the kind of the most famous or kind of well considered arguments for the causes of the Second World War, going all the way back to the kind of the 1960s and 70s, and one of the various waves of historiography on this subject was that of A.J.P. Taylor, who, I mean, A.J.P. Taylor is quite a kind of a controversialist and would say things that sounded kind of interesting and eye-catching, but one of his arguments was that it was a war by timetable, and what he literally meant was train timetables, that quite literally there were mobilisation plans on all sides, and when those began, then the process of going of all-out war across Europe was basically inevitable. Now, this has been challenging and contested, but today we're looking at Ring of Steel. We've talked about this excellent book before by Alexander Watson, and he's talking about the mobilisation of the German army. Now, previously, when we delved into this book, one of the things that Alexander Watson's pointed out is that for many Germans, the news of war, and Austro-Hungarians, the news of war was greeted with fear, worry, sadness, depression, every and all applicable negative emotions. Much of the kind of the stories about, you know, people cheering at the start of the war, well, those are kind of apocryphal tales for the most part. It did happen in certain instances at certain times, groups of kind of radical nationalist students, but to say that in Germany, in Austria, Hungary, large sections of the population were throwing their hats in the air is really not sustainable. There's not a lot of evidence for that at all. Anyway, Alexander Watson writes, military mobilisation changed the face of Central European societies with bewildering speed. Millions of men were immediately drafted. The Habsburg army expanded from a peacetime strength of 450,000 to 1,687,000 troops in 3.5 weeks. If you compare that to the 77,000 troops that the British Expeditionary Force had at the start of the war, it shows you the kind of the scale of things we're talking about. Its German ally achieved it in just 12 days, in an even more dramatic increase from 808,280 to 3,502,700 soldiers. That's a staggering increase in 12 days. Already by the middle of August 1914, around a quarter of Austro-Hungarian men aged 19 to 42 and one in every three German men aged 17 to 45 were with the colours. Reservists often had only a few days, in Germany sometimes no more than 24 hours, to set their affairs in order and say goodbyes before leaving for barracks. Younger men hurried to see their parents, bid farewell to work colleagues, perhaps once in uniform, had a snapshot taken with a sweetheart as a keepsake for the front. A happily married couple spent a final precious evening together. There were practicalities to organise. Farmers issued last-minute instructions to their wives. Men rushed to purchase essentials for active service. Officers in particular had much to do to put their kit in order. Departure was never easy. As Major Arthur Hausner, who had served since 1897 in the Habsburg army, confessed in his diary on the 27th of July 1914, even for professional soldiers who had spent their lives training for this moment, the possibility that one will never again see those he most loves constrains the feelings of enthusiasm. So the mobilisation of Habsburg and German armies is a kind of an enormous mass kind of spontaneous explosion really of human activity. It shows the kind of the rigour and organisation and also the militarisation that had always been there in Austro-Hungarian and especially German society, and the relationships, the very strong and powerful relationships between ordinary citizens' everyday life and the functioning of the military, and how ingrained military obligation was in both societies. But it also shows, as Arthur Hausner tells us there, this balance between reluctance and enthusiasm. And there was, for many young men, and again the British experience shows this as well, enthusiasm, that the tensions of the everyday and the often the kind of the boredoms and frustrations of everyday life were to be thrown off by the advent of war, and that for many this would be the great adventure, not the great national event, not just the great national adventure, but the great personal adventure too. The mood in Austria-Hungary, writes Watson, and Germany at the war's outbreak was defined by two intertwined emotions. Fear was the first, and it was endemic. The second, which developed to a great extent in reaction, was a feeling of communal solidarity. Fear is the more straightforward to explain, for its causes to the ways in which it was expressed were similar in both countries. Above all, Hausner hinted, people were afraid of the loss of their own or close relatives' lives. Although only the old could remember the last European wars fought by these states, the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71 and the Habsburg anti-insurgency campaign in Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1878-82. There was little naivety in either society about the coming conflagration. So people had quite a realistic sense of what this war would entail. For the most part, people in the during July 1914 were mainly considering what a war with Russia would look like. The idea of a war with France, well, that would probably happen too. The idea of a war with Great Britain, that was perhaps less considered. And in the eastern part of Germany, East Prussia, the fear of Russia led to many civilians getting onto crowded trains and making their way westward as quickly as possible. Russia, in the eyes of Germany, was the great threat to civilization, and this is what, in terms of social solidarity, brought in the Social Democratic Party to give their unconditional support for the war. This principle of social solidarity, the German term for it is Bergfried, or peace within the fortress. And that this unity was what the Kaiser depended upon, and it lasts till about 1916, and then fundamentally begins to break down with all sorts of extreme consequences for Germany by about 1918. Men and their families prepared for the worst. Church attendance surged, especially in Catholic regions. At Yablonkov, Father Siskala reported a remarkable crowd in his church on the 1st of August, the day after the general mobilization was ordered in Austria-Hungary. Whole packs of men departing for the army come to confession, and in the evening, till late into the night, prayers and singing reach the town from roadside crosses and chapels. War teaches people to pray. The socialist workers who populated Germany's major cities were less likely to turn for comfort to religion, but they too held few illusions about modern battle's lethality. All have the feeling of heading straight for the slaughterhouse, wrote one social democrat after he observed reservists departing in Bremen. Whether in town or country, monarchy or Reich, contemporaries everywhere agreed that this was a time of tears. Little could be heard but shouting, sighs and weeping when men left Sibiu in Transylvania, as middle-aged reservists gathered with their families south of Krakow. There was a good deal of crying and whimpering. Deep sadness and fear was also on display at German railway stations. Seeing the men depart is quite awful, wrote one girl, helping out at a refreshment stand on Kassel station during mobilisation. Some have tears in their eyes when they look at their women and children staying behind, and to see all the tearful faces of those staying behind too is terribly sad. So the part of the the driving force behind the emotions here is the fact of conscription, or the draft in these countries, in Austria-Hungary and Germany, which of course Britain didn't employ, at least not until 1916. The British Expeditionary Force and later Lord Kitchener's army swells with volunteers in 1914, and the war in Britain results in volunteering recruitment stations being overwhelmed with numbers. Still in 1916, when conscription is introduced, mainly as a result of a kind of a Daily Mail campaign, to target what the Daily Mail sees as kind of idlers and those not doing their bits, the levels of recruitment were so high still, the levels of voluntary recruitment were still so high in 1916 that there was literally not enough uniforms and equipment to give to the numbers of those still volunteering. So the impact of being compelled to fight, of having no choice in the matter, surely must have made those farewells all the more difficult.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
While apprehension about the separation and fears for the safety of sons and husbands account for much of the anxiety, there were also other good reasons to be tearful in August 1914. The start of the war precipitated an economic crisis threatening many families' material existence. In the countryside, farmers' wives wondered in despair how they would bring in the harvest when their husbands, workers and horses had been taken by the army. In the cities, by contrast, there was sudden mass unemployment. Around 5% of the workforce in Austria and a mere 2.7% of that in Germany had been without a job in July 1914. But in the following month, the proportions jumped respectively to 18.3% and 22.7%. Small businesses closed down as owners were called up, leaving workers on the streets. Larger firms, expecting war to suppress demand, downsized, put employees on short time. Or abruptly cut wages by, on average, 10% for men and up to 25% for women. So this is an economic body blow. This is the kind of economic disruption that you would equate with something like the Great Depression. A huge, huge economic disruption. Domestic trade was disrupted by military takeover of the railways. Export industry laid low as customers became enemies and contracts were cancelled. Siemens, for example, lost foreign orders for 5.8 million light bulbs. The dismissals and wage reductions caused severe hardship for working class families. So too did conscription itself. Even when once so-called family aid, a benefit given to German soldiers' families, was added, the drafting of a husband decreased income to a third of its pre-war level for the wife and child of an unskilled labourer, and to less than a quarter for those of a skilled labourer. So this is an extraordinary statistic. What this means is that for poor German families, the war was an economic catastrophe. In many ways, poor German families were subsidising the war. They were taking the economic hit by losing two-thirds or up to three-quarters of their entire family income. Wars pushed families into poverty in order that they could be fought in the first place. The difficulty that many families had in paying their landlords explains why a rumour that rents could not legally be demanded for the war's duration, although false, spread like wildfire. In Berlin, police were already reporting in late August material misery and growing desperation among the proletariat. The same was true elsewhere. A secret report on Austrian Galicia at the start of September described the pauperisation of our society and warned that official aid was urgently needed. Hungary, it warned menacingly, can be a bad advisor. So, again, this tells us some very interesting things, that the fact that the government reports saying that official aid would be needed means that a kind of new ways of conceiving about mobilisation, about ensuring that the entirety of society had to in some ways be aided, catered for, helped, assisted, in order to win the war, were being considered. The extent to which those things actually happen, of course, is a very moot point. Beyond these individual worries, there was a pervasive sense of threat, a fear, frequently refracted inwards, that the community was under attack. In Austria-Hungary, that feeling had, as we have seen, developed in many of the crown lands immediately after Franz Ferdinand's assassination. It was heightened further by the war's outbreak. The newly established War Supervision Office complained already on the 8th of August about the avalanche-like spread of all manner of totally uncontrollable rumours unsettling the Austrian population. Similar panic grabbed Germany once hostilities began. There, fears were inflamed by a government warning on the 2nd of August that Russian officers and agents are underway across the land. The warning implicitly appealed for vigilantism. The safety of the German Reich requires that the entire people cooperate without fail to neutralise such dangerous persons. Stories circulated of enemy attempts to poison the water supply, and of attacks on railways and telegraph lines. There were fears of air raids. Phantom flyers were reported over Berlin. The country was seized by a spy hysteria. The Reichstag deputy, Hans-Peter Hansen, described how the capital's Potsdamer Platz on the 3rd of August saw an enraged mob beat a man unmercifully with clubs and umbrellas. This, he was told, was the fourth spy they had caught in the last half hour. So the spy hysteria which Britain had undergone in the kind of the 5 years before the war, obsessed with the possible threat of German spies stealing British naval secrets, and the careers of writers like John Buchan, for example, were born of this moment, and Erskine Childers, who wrote The Riddle of the Sands. There was this kind of wild hysteria. And you see it again in 1914, and to a lesser degree in Britain as well. But all these things are generally kind of conveniently propagated by the state, and it's always a very useful thing to drive people mad with fear and anxiety. If there were spies, and no doubt there were, in Germany and Austria, they weren't doing things like poisoning the water supply. And the way in which mob violence works in a way is kind of how people externalise their anxieties and fears, normally in kind of quite brutal fashions. The anxiety was greatest in places close to the frontiers, and with the ethnically mixed populations. The fortress city of Pezen, 55 kilometres inside Germany's eastern borders, offers a great example. There, the outbreak of the war was exceptionally fraught, as the city was situated within a ring of forts guarding one of the key approaches into the Reich. The Polish and German inhabitants were warned already on the 1st of August that if the Russian army approached, any people without sufficient provisions to withstand the siege would be evacuated. All households were ordered to register with the police and state their preferred destination. Nervous about the external threat, the German minority quickly came to regard their Polish neighbours, with whom peacetime relations had not been warm, with similar trepidation. Terrorism was feared. Already on the 3rd of August, there was a bomb scare, and the military was called after somebody left a travel hamper in a bank. Some even imagined that local Poles were planning insurrection. One zealous non-commissioned officer sent the police a letter, bizarre even for those anxious times, cataloguing a list of suspicious incidents which, he argued, indicated preparations for a Polish uprising were well underway. Women were, he claimed, pushing prams containing child-sized dolls through the city, always along the same route, waiting at a tailor's workshop. He had seen 6 civilians come in, all of whom had ordered tunics to the rank of Feldwebel-Lieutenant, a junior officer rank, and then argued with the tailor over the price. Girls, the soldier worried, were entering the barracks and leaving with packages. He was sure they must contain rifle cartridges. Perhaps what most concerned him was the last point in the letter. I am often asked by Polish girls whether I am Polish. I request urgently that measures be taken. So, of course, there are always kind of unhinged people, particularly in any given society, who are very agitated at these times. But it shows us a general kind of pervading sense of fear, of crisis, or panic, even though much of it is the kind of the stuff of fantasy, and the realities of war for many of these people, whilst brutal and bloody, would be far more mundane and everyday. The great thing about this book, and I do recommend if you want to read about the First World War, get this book. It really, really is good. Is it shows you a narrative that to kind of Anglo-American audiences is often very unfamiliar. The everyday experience of German people, the everyday experience of German soldiers, and the normalisation of that war for them was every bit the crisis and the catastrophe it was for anybody else. We're going to continue with this in the next couple of months, hopefully. Continue looking at what Alexander Watson is talking about mobilisation here. But one thing we can definitely view from this is that mobilisation for many Germans was experienced as a hammer blow to their society. Of economic crisis, anxiety and loss. Anyway, thanks very much, and thanks for listening to the podcast. You can check us out at www.explaininghistory.org. There's some exciting plans coming. I'm currently writing a study course on the Russian Revolution, and more details on that soon. Do support us on the Patreon if you can. Thanks very much, all the best, bye bye.
Glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.